Does Friendly have a taste? If it does, it's probably like Hello's peppermint-flavored anti-plaque and whitening toothpaste. Brush away plaque, show tartar who's boss, and remove surface stains to naturally whiten. Hello's thoughtful and flavor-forward products make brushing your teeth feel like a confetti-filled bathroom dance party. So say hello to Hello with the always cruelty-free, never tested on animals toothpaste that's made to spread smiles. Visit HelloProducts.com and let Hello add some everyday yay into your life.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Hotel Mars, episode N. Dr. Livingston, Dr. Space is here. We are on our way to the far distance origins and more of our cosmos, our existence, thanks to a new machine, robot called SphereX, launched on March 11th, now operational. And I welcome the principal scientist to help us understand what SphereX, the mission, and the results to look for in the coming years. I welcome California Institute of Technology, Marvin L. Goldberger Professor of Physics, Jamie Bach. He is also a senior research scientist at the Jet Propulsion Lab. Professor, a very good evening to you. SphereX's mission is so vast. What is the first thing you're looking for to it achieve, and how's it going to do it? Good evening to you.
Oh, yeah, great to be here. Happy to tell you about SphereX. It's super exciting since we just started our science observations. Well, SphereX does a lot. We've got some very exciting core science. I would say the thing I'm most excited about is we are going to make a big three-dimensional map of the position of galaxies. And we know that galaxies like to cluster together, but that structure that we see on very big scales was actually imprinted from the Big Bang itself. So one of the things we can do with SphereX is look back at how the Big Bang occurred and how we see these galaxies distributed over the whole sky.
You're going to map the sky. Is that it? Everything around us.
Well, that's right. And so in doing that, we map the entire sky, the entire celestial sphere. And we're doing that in a new way. The sky's been mapped before at multiple wavelengths, but we're doing it in 102 near-infrared colors, which is the first time it's been observed like that. So as you can imagine, when you do something new for the first time, there's the potential to learn new things. So that data set is just going to be a treasure trove for astronomers to do all sorts of things.
I'm looking at a photograph that NASA provides of SphereX in a clean room before its launch. I hope I don't misstate. It looks like a cardinal's hat. Is that the idea here? You know, the marching in Rome right now reminds me of this.
Yeah. It has a very unusual structure. It sort of looks like a dog's cone of shame.
Right.
It has these cones. There's actually three of these cones. And that's a unique design that we came up with. And the thing is because we observe in the infrared, we are sensitive to heat or thermal emission. So we don't want to see the telescope or detectors glowing. And in order to eliminate their infrared light, we have to cool them to low temperatures. And that's actually pretty hard to do when you're going around the Earth in low Earth orbit, because the Earth is warm, plus you have the sun. And so we wanted to cool everything without stored coolants and without like a mechanical cooler. So we just cool to the coldness of space, and those cones let heat from the instrument, bounce out to the cold of space to cool the telescope and detectors to very low temperatures. And that has actually worked great. And those cones then also protect the cold instrument from seeing the sun and the Earth.
David, you have a question for the professor.
Yes, I read in the literature that you scan for every 6 months. So how long does a scan take? And then do you resume scanning the same areas looking for changes, or do you shift to a new change? And you're in both infrared and regular light, so is everything combined together in your images, or do you have to use separate images when you're doing the scanning?
Yeah, so I'll just say the way we get all the wavelengths, which are actually just longer than optical, just longer than your eye can see, out to about, you know, 10 times the wavelengths you see with your eye. We do that by taking a series of pictures. So we take about 3,600 pictures a day. And as we're going around the Earth, we take this series of snapshots and we move them a little bit each time we take a picture. Each picture takes about 2 minutes. And moving the picture, we get all the colors. They build up over time. Takes a while. And we're generally looking like 90 degrees from the sun, going around the sunrise-sunset line on the Earth. And as the Earth rotates around the sun, that circle rotates. So you imagine that circle moving 180 degrees as the Earth goes around in 6 months, summer to winter, say. The circle then closes. And so then you map the entire sky after 6 months. We do that then every 6 months for 2 years. So we get four surveys. They are shifted a little bit so that we can fill in the wavelengths. And then having these multiple surveys allows us to build up sensitivity and also to look for any kind of time-dependent phenomenon. So, you know, some stars are variable. For certain science, that's interesting. For other science, it's you don't want them, so you need to know that. There's moving objects like asteroids and so forth. And so having this long time base is helpful for many things.
Professor, as you know, the James Webb Space Telescope keeps tossing up mysteries about the beginning, not only the Big Bang, but also about, for example, a spiral galaxy that's right now understood to have formed much too soon for a spiral galaxy to have formed. Is the SpheREx going to augment that mystery? That will it help solve the mystery?
So SpheREx and JWST are really quite different things. So I'd say, like, imagine you're in base camp at Mount Everest, and with JWST, it's like the telescope that can zoom in, and you can see the climbers as they're up at the summit of Mount Everest. SpheREx is more like the pano mode on your iPhone. So you can see the whole range of the Himalayas. You get this huge broad view. And so those are, you know, really quite different ways of doing science. The period that you're referring to, astronomers sometimes call cosmic dawn. So it's like when the first galaxies are starting to form, the first stars are starting to form and just turning on. And it's interesting because they're forming out of the material that came from the Big Bang, which is mostly hydrogen and helium, without the enrichment of heavier elements that we have now from generations of stars forming. And so it's a bit of a mystery how that process went. And JWST is now zooming in and finding galaxies, you know, way at the very beginning, individual guys, and, you know, wondering how that process happened. SpheREx is a small telescope. So we're not going to go zoom in on those individual objects, but we're doing something that's really different. And what we're doing is we're looking for the total glow produced by galaxies. So you can't see the individual ones, but you see the total emission that everything produced. And that's all kinds of galaxies plus anything else. And in that overall glow is a component from that first period of galaxy formation. It's going to be faint, but it'll have also distinctive colors. And we aspire to pull it out. It's going to be quite a challenge. But that signal will tell us that kind of in aggregate how that period of cosmic dawn took place. And JWST will zoom in on the, you know, individual objects, which might be also spectacular. Putting those two together gives you a much more complete picture than just having one or the other.
Thank you, David.
Also, in reading your literature, I noticed that you're relying on guidance and rotational wheels for stability. And that makes me think of Hubble and the problem they've had with those wheels. So Is this an okay technology to keep SphereX working and on track? I just think of the problems that Hubble has had from these wheels.
Right, right. So, yes, we as we're orbiting the Earth, the way we point is basically we use wheels. We exchange momentum with these wheels and the telescope and spacecraft. So we can, you know, stably point and then slew to the next position. There are four wheels, so there is a little bit of redundancy there. Generally, we're a single string mission, which means we don't have redundancy. So we have a little bit of redundancy with the wheels. Things have improved with the wheels since the days of Hubble. But we rely on these wheels, and we don't have any propellant, for example, just to keep it as simple as possible. And we rely on the excellent performance of the wheels.
In the Wikipedia write-up, it indicates you're after a number of mysteries. This makes you Sherlock Holmes here of the universe. The one that seemed completely new to me is the origin of water in planetary systems. How do you look for that? What's it look like?
So, it's really getting to the question of what are the building blocks for life? And, well, the only example of life we have is on Earth. But we know on Earth, life, the single ingredient that's important for life is liquid water. And one might ask, where did that water come from? We think it came in the formation of the Earth as the solar system formed, when the sun was born, that water arrived in the form, formed out in interstellar space. And so the interesting thing is if you're looking for water in our galaxy, most of that water is actually in the form of ice, not vapor or liquid. And it forms on the outer parts of interstellar dust grains through very slow interstellar chemistry. So we think that's where the water initially was born that got to Earth. How it got there is a mystery, exactly. But the origin was in these icy reservoirs. And so with SphereX, we're going to make a big survey of the abundance of icy water in the early stages of star and planet formation. And it's really just the building blocks. That's the beginning of the story. You need water to form life as we know it on Earth. And knowing how abundant it is and under what conditions is what we'll be doing with this big survey, where we're going to be looking along millions of lines of sight to measure its abundance. And it's not just water. There's some other building blocks with carbon and oxygen that are also in the form of ices that we'll be tracing out.
So you really are looking for the origin of water, suggesting there was a time. No, time is wrong. There was a place where water did not exist.
Well, we think it formed again through these dust grains are kind of sites of interstellar chemistry where materials can form through chemical reactions on the surface. So that's kind of the beginning of it. Also, those icy dust grains, as you can imagine, when the sun, a star starts to form and a disk forms, those icy materials then, stick together and turn into the building blocks of the objects in the solar system.
David, you have a question. We have a couple of minutes.
Since it's been scanning since May 1st, is it sending any imagery back to you? What are you seeing so far? I know it's only been 7 days, but can you see it working already?
Oh, yeah. So we get downlinks of data several times a day through ground stations that are generally in the Antarctic or Arctic, because we're orbiting pole to pole. So that's where we tend to go over the Earth the most. And so that's where we telemeter down our data. So we get several downloads of data and we can see the quality of the images and, see how the survey's coming together through that process. So we're in regular contact with spacecraft.
Are you happy with what you're seeing?
We're always looking for problems, of course, but yes, generally we are happy. The spacecraft and the instrument are pretty happy and working well. And so far, everything looks pretty good.
I note the official indication is a mission duration of 25 months, but a number of NASA robots have exceeded their lifespan by several times. Are you expecting this to last much longer than 25 months?
Well, we have no consumables. So we have no propellant, we have no coolants, and there's nothing that ends the lifetime of the instrument, and unless something breaks, God forbid. Ultimately, the orbit is designed to decay within 25 years. So that would be the ultimate time limit. But we should, if things continue to work, we should be able to function for quite a bit longer than that 25 months.
Boy, that's a lot of data, Jamie. Whoa, 25.
It's a lot of data. Yeah, we're kind of drowning in a fire hose of data right now, actually.
Yes, I can see. And there's some indication, everybody go to the Wikipedia page, there's indication of what they're first seeing from SpheraX.
We did put out some early images just to give a little bit of a taste. It takes a while to get all the wavelengths to come in, so that's still coming. And that's really what makes SpheraX unique.
We're speaking to James J. Jamie Bock at Caltech, Marvin L. Goldberger Professor of Physics, and at JPL Senior Research Scientist, David Livingston, Dr. Space.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This message is sponsored by Greenlight. With school out, summer is the perfect time to teach our kids real-world money skills they'll use forever. Greenlight is a debit card and the number one family finance and safety app used by millions of families, helping kids learn how to save, invest, and spend wisely. Parents can send their kids money and track their spending and saving, while kids build money confidence and skills in fun ways. Start your risk-free Greenlight trial today at greenlight.com/iHeart. That's greenlight.com/iHeart.
Not all meals are created equal. For instance, breakfast has the spicy egg McMuffin for a limited time, and lunch doesn't. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.